Yeah, I'm Chinese. And what?
Today in Studio 360.
今日的三六零录音室。
Chinese artists mean business.
Y'all gonna learn Chinese. Y'all gonna learn Chinese.
Yeah, they may rap like Americans, but these days members of the Chinese creative class are defining success on their own terms.
It's called playing the Chinese card.
But I say is I'm Chinese. Of course, I play in Chinese card. I'm Chinese.
And director Ang Lee tells us why Lust Caution, his new sexually explicit movie about China, pushed him out of his comfort zone.
I don't know what to make of it. First of all, I'm sexually repressed.
The new Chinese cultural revolution happening right now. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI.
请听今日的 PRI 360录音室。
Right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of PRI Studio 360, where each week, Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support the show by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
It sometimes seems that China, the People's Republic, is two different countries.
More than 350,000 children's products and toys, all made in communist China, were recalled this week. The toys violate the federal ban on lead paint.
That's one China, fast, cheap, and out of control. Contaminated toothpaste, lead paint on Thomas the Tank Engine. That's the China whose Communist Party put a media blackout on the start of the SARS epidemic 4 years ago.Then there's the totally different China we hear about. Modern, thriving, transforming itself overnight. More capitalist than the West. Kind of cool. A place where artists who were persecuted just a few years ago now sell pieces for a couple of million dollars. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this hour in Studio 360, we're going to look at the new China and its booming culture.We'll talk with all kinds of people, including the great film director Ang Lee, whose new movie takes us to China during World War II. But first, visual art. Jocelyn Ford's a reporter who's been based in Beijing for years. She told us about an epicenter of China's contemporary art scene, a small town where more than 1,000 artists now live.Jocelyn, I'm going to let you be the first to pronounce the name of that town. What is it?
Sure, it's Songjiang.
And when did you first go there?
I first went there in 2002. And in fact, it was an editor who was visiting from the U.S. who said, hey, I want to go see the cutting edge of China, what's coming down the road in the future. So she said, let's go visit the artist.
And when you went there 5 years ago and went there more recently for us, had it changed in that time?
Had it changed? An understatement of the year. It's a completely different village from when I went to.
Artists are everywhere are want to sort of, you know, push the edge of the envelope. Do you see that kind of thing going on out there?
Well, for your story, I wanted to get some great sound. So I decided to go to an opening. It was in a brand new gallery that was in a former chicken farm, sort of underground. And when I got there, the problem was that everybody at the opening had already rushed out the door because one of the artists lit fireworks underground, smoked up the whole place. Lucky it didn't catch on fire, but we couldn't see any of the art.
And so when you say underground, you're not speaking figuratively. You mean it was literally under the ground?
Literally, sort of a half-buried chicken farm factory.
Wow. Let's listen to your report from Songjiang.
Okay, great.
Are you going to Songjiang? Shapuchuma.
To get to China's artist village, you can take a minibus from downtown Beijing.
You step on a little minibus with tattered cloth covers on the seats and boxes piled up.
You can tell you're headed out of town. The passengers have that leathery look of people who've spent their lives toiling in the fields under the hot sun. And then there was the odd one out, the woman talking about the gallery opening.
So there is, this afternoon, there is the opening of an exhibition in Songjiang.
Her Nance is a graduate student from France. She's heading to Songjiang to do research for her thesis.
Chinese contemporary art is booming and you hear about it everywhere, so I wanted to know what is behind this, Chinese contemporary art in Europe or in the US.
Songzhuang is about an hour outside of Beijing. It used to be a regular impoverished village. Farmers grew corn. There were a few small factories. And then its fate took a strange turn. In the aftermath of the 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown, authorities started going after artists who lived together in a community in Beijing. They tore down their homes and chased out of town about 300 of them. But the tiny village at the center of Songzhuang district had a hard-headed leader. Cao Dabai had a use for the outcasts.
At that time, all I knew was that farmers could earn more from renting or selling their homes than they could from planting fields.
He had no idea what his decision would mean for his farming hamlet, population 1,500, a decade later.
Right, brand new highway. Brand new highway, there even the tractor's still here. Something's going well in this town. The first time I came here, it was really run down. The roads were all full of potholes. There was no huge sign saying Songzhuang, China.
Yeah, I think it's kind of brand they want to create.
The ambitious village has registered its name as a trademark and aims to become known internationally as the home of China's contemporary art scene. Today's Songzhuang could be a poster child for modernizing rural China. The brand new shops on the single main road already look shabby and cluttered, like the dusty shops they replaced. There are pool tables by the side of the road, a favorite pastime in rural China, just not done in sophisticated cities. Then there's the postmodern gallery restaurant with works by local artists. Not too far away, down a little lane, lives artist Wang Chouren. Like the other early comers, Wang refurbished a farmhouse inside a walled enclosure with a big gate.
When I moved here, there wasn't even a restaurant. We had to go 20 minutes to town to go to a restaurant.
Back then, he says, moving to Songzhuang was like moving to Siberia.
Back then, there were too many political struggles. But artists were still idealistic. They painted to express themselves. Now artists move here because they want to make money.
Wang has found a new escape. He used to paint with oils because they were Western and modern. A few years ago, he switched back to traditional Chinese landscape painting with ink and paper.
I started to think that society is moving too quickly, so nowadays traditional painting is more important.
Traditionally, ink painting was a part of the Chinese intellectual's contemplative lifestyle. But today in Songzhuang, that quiet life is becoming hard to find. The price of housing is soaring, and farmers are now fighting with artists to get back their land. Cornfields are being plowed under to construct brand new galleries and art museums. There are already six. Investors are building posh studios for the artists. Behind the real estate rush are Western art collectors. And for the local communist leaders, their former liability, the artists, are now an asset. Here's Hu Jiabao, the secretary general of the Communist Party for the entire Songzhuang district. He's an affable, clean-cut man in his 40s. He's guzzling beer at the Rubueno Bar and Gallery with a long-haired Filipino slacker, the bar owner's boyfriend. 3 years ago, Hu Jiabao read in a Communist Party newspaper that culture and entertainment account for over half of the economy in the United States, but only 5% in China. Now he heads a pyramid of governmental and private associations that help arrange exhibitions and woo potential investors. When Hu Jiabao is not hobnobbing with artists, he's often found giving village tours to official delegations. Like this one, a group of elite politicians, roughly the equivalent of our congressional representatives. They've come because the central government now wants non-polluting economic growth. So they're on a study tour to learn how to nurture clean industries like art. In his most officious communist-style presentation, Hu Jiabao lectures the crowd about New York City's Soho, or Suhe in Chinese. Hu has never been to New York, but he describes with authority how the rundown warehouse district was transformed into a world-famous art center. Never mind that the New York art scene has since moved to Chelsea. Hu Jiabao has never heard of Chelsea. He then brings the visiting dignitaries on a gallery tour.
So a full-breasted, pig-headed woman's body pulling down her panties.
Hu Jiabao explains to his guests, the image of the large blue piggy was inspired by the Chinese animal zodiac. It was painted for the Year of the Pig. Only a few years ago, the blue piggy painting would surely have been banned. When I ask about censorship, Party Secretary Hu asserts, China is now open. Censorship is not a problem. Not in the blue piggy gallery, maybe. But it sure was a problem down the street at Sung Zhuang's first documentary film festival. The festival was organized by Li Xianting, China's best-known art critic. The festival screened some controversial documentaries, like this woman's retelling of a gang rape by her high school boyfriend's father and his gambling friends. Other films addressed minorities losing their identity, homelessness, and the forced eviction of artists from Beijing.
Generally, the society, everything is so prosperous and everything. But the documentary films tell the truth, the more harsh reality of the real world.
But censors don't like harsh reality. In the theater, a member of the audience whispered to me,
always people sit in the audience to check after they left around 10th.
She said censors lurk among the audience. So one time, the organizers pretended to be finished for the day. And then, when the miners went home, they secretly screened films in the middle of the night. One was about the Tiananmen crackdown. Li Xianting says he's prepared to be in constant battle for artistic freedom, and he doesn't mind that the government is gaga over commercial prospects of art. But he says there needs to be a balance. Commercialism is to art, he says, as water is to a boat.
Like a water and boat, it can support it, it can also overturn it.
Water can keep a boat afloat, but it can also capsize it.
It's probably going to be submerged soon, the boat.
Reporting from the artist village of Sung Zhuang, China, I'm Jocelyn Ford for Studio 360.
You can also hear Jocelyn Ford's interview with Fang Fang, the art mogul who runs Beijing's Very Hot Star Gallery. That's only available at studio360.org. Coming up, a Chinese dancer at home on Long Island can't stop reliving the past.
People are behind her shouting, "Dang, Zheng Tingfang, dang," you know. Then people coming to hit her. I saw a bottle of ink landed on her face and then covered her face.
Decades after the fact, the Cultural Revolution still casts a long shadow. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. People used to call China the sleeping giant. How quaint. I'm Kurt Anderson, and in Studio 360 today, we're looking at how we in the West are starting to see a lot more of China and its culture. To get some perspective and a bit of an overview on this, I've invited Orville Schell into the studio. He is the author of 9 books about modern China, most recently Virtual Tibet. He was a journalist there for years, and he now heads the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York. Orville, welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
Is there a sense among the artistic class that there is something good even about having this authoritarian state apparatus to push against?
That's a very interesting observation. I think it's undeniably true that, you know, the art always, I think, gains immeasurable vibrancy when it's in tension with something. And God knows Chinese artists have had plenty to be in tension with. And it's interesting how they've mined the past. You know, they've mined all of the music of the Cultural Revolution. They've mined the iconography of Chairman Mao. They've mined, the whole experience of the Cultural Revolution in literature. now as the tension begins to diminish, in a certain sense, it becomes more normal and more like just art anywhere. But it also loses a kind of a critical identity. And these artists very often kind of float away into the conceptual world. And suddenly, they're not maybe as interesting, as distinguished, and as readily accessible because there's nothing that they incorporate that's resisting.
I've read about this extraordinary market with hundreds of thousands, $1 million being paid for works of art, some of it now by domestic buyers.
I mean, $1 million and more. China now has 106 billionaires.
Really?
Yeah. To be a millionaire is small potatoes. And so these people are casting around for something to do, some spiritual basis to sustain them, some sort of artistic side. And, you know, they're like rich people everywhere. What do I do with my money?
We hear the term soft power. What does soft power mean?
Soft power for China means restoring what it views as its rightful place as a culture to which the rest of the world pays tribute. And of course, for so long, it was exactly that. I mean, all of Asia paid tribute to China and borrowed Chinese culture, Korea, Vietnam, Japan. So I think it has a sort of an innate kind of, it has a recessive gene that still codes for that yearning of grandness and importance.
How are they exercising that? Are they coming in and funding institutes and foundations and things in North America?
Well, the party is sending language teachers all over the world, and they have the Ministry of Education has set up this whole sort of Confucius Institute network. And if you're some small college in Louisiana, you too can have a Confucius Institute. You just sort of phone in.
And this is something they don't just idly wish for, but sort of strategically seek.
Yes, and this is exactly what the Olympics are all about. This is for them to really plant the flag.
Is that a hugely important project to them?
It is hugely important. I mean, this is like China's coming out party, bar mitzvah, communion, you know, all rolled into one. And they are recklessly proud of what they've done. And what they have done is quite astounding. I mean, they have built an Olympic Park that is incomparable. And they have sort of redecorated the whole city of Beijing, you know, planted trees and along all the ring roads and freeways. There's amazing, you know, landscaping and buildings going up. And if they succeed, it would be a great step forward for China. But of course, there's also the risk of failure, that all of the, you know, people who for independent Tibet, environmentalists, Taiwan, Falun Gong, I mean, you name it, there are legion, the groups that would like to get in there and be heard and protest, and many within China as well. So what are they going to do about that? Well, no one quite knows.
This is a great opportunity for all of those little constituencies that want their particular form of freedom from Chinese oppression. They can use this next year, yes?
Yes. And therein lies the problem. I mean, Mia Farrow did one of the great branding triumphs of modern advertising history when she wondered out loud whether China wanted to have the genocide Olympics because of its role in extracting oil from Sudan. And then, of course, she had the second sort of most stinging branding victory when she asked Steven Spielberg if he wanted to be known as the Leni Riefenstahl of the 2008 Olympics because he was going to produce the opening night. Well, these are the kind of things that China worries about, and these are the kinds of things that can really put a torpedo through the bow of soft power.
Orvachel, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360.
My pleasure.
Orville Schell heads the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York. In the sort of old days, the 80s and 90s, Chinese artists who got attention abroad often emigrated. They set up in Australia or France or the U.S. Melissa Chu, who's museum director of the Asia Society, has noticed something interesting. The longer these artists live overseas,
and now most of them have lived outside China for over 10 years,
the more Chinese their works look. They play with old-fashioned Chinese subjects and materials like ink and gunpowder, even tea.
Although you wouldn't necessarily describe it as a nostalgia for China, I think that there's a recognition on the part of these artists that they really, their formative years, their background culture is Chinese.
Studio 360's Lou Olkowski visited some of these artists to find out why and how they're holding on to the past.
Yin Mei lives a pretty regular life out in the suburbs on Long Island. She has a husband, two kids, and a big dog.
Do you need me to get Fluffy?
If you can just wait until she does not bark.
Let me bring Fluffy into
the
kitchen.
Yeah, sure, so that would be great.
In 1985, she came from Luoyang, China, for a dance and choreography fellowship. And now she does a performance where she drenches herself in ink and languidly drags herself across the floor, using her body to write calligraphy on long scrolls of paper. It looks kind of exotic and beautiful. But ink has some pretty dark associations for her.
Well, everybody knows this. During the Cultural Revolution, when you want to humiliate people, you have a meeting. And in the beginning, they are only using words and starting to yell. And later on, they're starting to use hands to hitting you. This is very, very common. And then when further on, they want to humiliate you, they're pouring a bottle of ink covered with your body. And they cut your hair halfway. So everywhere, everybody knows that you are a counter-revolutionary. You are a spy.
Yin Mei goes on to tell a story about one of her mother's friends.
She is a small leader at the time. She was considered a capitalist dog.
And one day, as this friend was walking home, she was followed by an angry mob beating drums and gongs.
People are behind her shouting, "Dang, Zheng Tingfang, dang," you know, and people coming to hit her. I saw a bottle of ink landed on her face and then covered her face. That evening, the institute have a public bath. And when I come in to the bath, and I saw a woman facing back in the corner, and her back, I thought she was wearing a clothes. And then I look at her. Those are bruises. Her whole back, it was all bruises. Blue mark, blue-black mark. And that is in my mind. When I'm talking to you, I see where she was and in that corner and all of that.
As the dance ends, Yin Mei stands and faces the audience as green tea powder pours over her ink-stained body. It's not just dancers who are using traditional ink and calligraphy as metaphors. Take the artist Xu Bing. The son of two professors, he was taught that being a good calligrapher was a sign of being educated and cultured. And in Beijing, he was known as being kind of a joker and a word geek. So when he got to the U.S., he thought he'd play around with the English language, the same way he played with Chinese.
Yeah, my English is really terrible. Yeah, really limited. So I always bother me, you know, between the two languages, yeah.
He invented a writing system. He took English words and squeezed all the letters together to look like calligraphied characters. So like China, C, H, I, N, and A formed into one beautifully drawn symbol. At first glance, it looks just like Chinese, but it can only be read by English speakers.
That piece really explained about my situation or my personal life, you know, yeah.
It's called square word calligraphy.
Square word calligraphy is really show your really real true Chinese face, right? But inside is totally is doesn't relate with the Chinese, like living in between the two cultures.
Xu Bing is an international art star. But back in China, not everyone is proud of the overseas artists. The loudest critic is a guy named Wang Nanming. He's made a name for himself because he's one of the only art critics in China who actually criticizes anything. When I called him up in Shanghai, he compared overseas Chinese art to a Chinatown dinner.
So for Westerners to have food there in Chinatown, they would think that this is wonderful, and that's the understanding of what Chinese food should be.
So like we eat bad Chinese food? We're looking at bad Chinese art?
The more superficial the artwork is, the more positive reaction you get from the Western viewers.
The artist Xu Bing again.
They think I'm getting successful because I use a Chinese symbol. It's called打中国牌. Play Chinese card. Eh?
Yeah, it's called playing the Chinese card.
Play the Chinese card. But I say is I'm Chinese. I play in Chinese car. You I'm Chinese. You say, oh, you couldn't play Chinese car. You play American car.
You should play the Italian card.
It's
like the people who have that opinion are people that don't have confidence in their own culture.
A work of Chinese art that Wang Nanming, the critic, really likes was an installation of used tampons collected from women around the world. No reference to China or the past, but very modern.
So the reason why I like it is because it creates controversy.
Kind of like Chairman Mao, Wang Nanming thinks the past is a burden. But what if you use a classical style to talk about contemporary issues? A London-based artist, Yun Feiji, makes ink landscapes. They resemble Song Dynasty paintings, but they're not exactly lyrical. One painting shows a bunch of Western tourists on a luxury liner.
Someone is laying on the swimming pool on the boat and drinking and having a party and then taking endless photographs of the beautiful scene. And then on the shore, you have people who are moving. Have animals stuck in a car, and they have all the belongings piled up, and ruins and things.
Bon Voyage is about the massive Three Gorges Dam built on the Yangtze River.
I'm always interested in this these big projects, these things that are supposed to bring China into modern era. Like, look what we can do, build the world's largest dam. Very proud, you know. But the consequence, the result is almost 2 million people have to be displaced. So I'm always very skeptical of some of these big ideas that would fix everything, you know.
But does the ink painting exoticize China's environmental problems?
You have to be a little bit careful about using it to say exoticizing, because there's some genuine interest in a culture that's so different from your own, which is totally healthy, totally good. And then the attraction is both ways. So we also exoticize the West.
For Studio 360, I'm Lou Olkowski.
You can see work by some of these artists at studio360.org. Earlier this year, the United Nations reported that the urban population of the planet now equals the rural population for the first time in history. Nowhere is the massiveness and suddenness of this shift to urban life more evident than in China, where more than 100 million people have left the countryside seeking a new life in the booming cities. The migrants lead hard and sometimes dangerous lives. Gideon D'Arcangelo went to Beijing to seek out music that is expressing what these new urbanites are going through.
During his lunch break at a construction site, Li Jianmin, a migrant worker from central China, is listening to music on his cell phone.
When it first came out, I thought it was just a good song. But later I felt that his voice and melody speaks directly to my mood, our feelings as migrant workers.
The song is called The First Snow of 2002 by Dao Lung, a rustic love song about life in the country popular among many migrant workers in Beijing. When I held you, croons Dao Lung, I forgot the biting coldness of the wind in the north.
In life, I think the biggest problem is that there is a very large gap between my dreams and cruel reality.
That's Yang Zhihao. He also came to Beijing to work construction and better his situation, only to find himself barely breaking even, his home, a grim, ramshackle dorm right on the construction site.
I feel homesick when I am alone, especially in the night, because in the daytime I'm always too busy to be homesick. Far away from home, I miss you so much, my dearest mom. I've drifted by many places, but none of them I would call home. Winter wind is blowing and snow is falling. I cannot hold my tears.
In the evening, Yang Zhihao sometimes sings this song. It is known as the Drifter's Song, written by a songwriter named Chen Xing. His name came up a few days later at a labor market for restaurant workers on a Beijing back street.
His songs are exactly the same as our experience, so it fills my psychological needs.
Li Jianhong said Chen Xing's lyrics hit the nail right on the head.
His songs always describe the feeling that you have a hard life, you can't find a job, and you don't have enough money to eat. You're like a man lost in the city without a home.
Chen Xing was born into a working-class family in southern China. His songs offer an alternative to the slick pop from Taiwan and Hong Kong that dominates the airwaves here. Here's Chen Xing.
You know, China is a very big country, and population flow is big as well. And these migrant people, they need care and love. So I think it's necessary to bring them some music to comfort their hearts.
With guitar resting on his knee, Chen Xing picks out the Drifter song. Dr. Mei Xiao is an ethnomusicologist at the Shanghai Conservatory of Music. She says that people in China are just now starting to take note of the emerging culture of migrant workers.
I think there are two main reasons why so many migrant workers like Chen Xing. The first is that Chen Xing makes use of many rural music forms, so the migrant workers here in the urban area like it, because it's easy to sing. The second reason is a lyric. It's all about their real life of migration.
Adapting country styles and fitting them with lyrics that echo life in the city, Chen Xing's songs are similar to other styles born of migration, like the urban blues or bluegrass in America.
For many long years, I traveled in sorrow.
These styles were forged as southern farm workers hit the industrial cities of the Midwest. The themes are similar, too, about rambling, missing dear old mom, wandering in the city and longing for a lost home.
I think I can summarize all their emotions with one phrase. It's hard. First of all, it's hard for migrant workers to make a living in a big city. And second, it's hard for them to find the job they always wanted. And third, it's hard to find someone to care about them.
In his new songs, Chen Xing finds a way to strike a note of optimism. In Migrant Worker's Love Song, he wonders if a poor lonely guy far away from home will find the life he's looking for in the big city.
I
我和你一样有太多的感伤，你不用问我，我不用问你来自何方，当你需要我会来到你身旁。
On the way to work I meet you, there's so much sadness I share with you. We never ask, where are you from? But when you need me, I'll be there for you. We fall in love when we work together. There are so many expectations we share together. We bring each other the hope of happiness.
I'm Gideon D'Arcangelo for Studio 360.
Gideon D'Arcangelo's photographs of the workers he met in Beijing are online at studio360.org. And coming up, we venture south to Shanghai with Oscar-winning director Ang Lee.
I thought I'd never had a chance to make this movie in China, just the theme itself, just what it's about. This subject matter, the Wang Jingwei government, was never allowed to be portrayed, period.
Lee's sumptuous new movie, Lust Caution, uncovers a hidden chapter of China's history. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. You can picture the scene, a secret cell of student resistors in an occupied country. A young woman assigned to kill the head of the secret police. And to get close to him, she has to seduce him first. But this isn't Hitchcock or Berlin. This is 1940s China, when Shanghai was occupied by the Japanese. And the director of the film, Lust Caution, is the remarkable Ang Lee. He's made a career out of telling love stories set in unforgiving circumstances, including Brokeback Mountain and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Ang Lee is here with the screenwriter and producer of Lust Caution and other of his films, James Shamus. Welcome to Studio 360.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So Lust Caution is about a group of young theater students who meet at university and almost immediately begin plotting to assassinate a Chinese official in the Japanese-controlled puppet government. You grew up in Taiwan. Did this period of Chinese history have a different meaning for you, given how you'd been educated about the 1940s?
It was quite the opposite from the truth. Now, we talk about the heroic war against the Japanese, but this part is very much hidden in our history in terms of education to my generation, because they regard as a sham, the puppet government, national disgrace. They're traitors. So there's never a film that's done based on this period of time.
Huh, that's interesting. Did you have to do, James, a lot of homework, research in Chinese history to write this script?
Yeah, you know, I think my purpose and role in this was trying to think cinematically. There's a moment halfway in the picture when all these silly young students who are trying to become resistance heroes are faced with having to perform a real murder. And to me, the inspiration came from a number of places, including movies like The Conformist, you know, Bertolucci's Conformist, which also takes place in World War II and also includes a scene of a stabbing, the famous one in the woods, where a number of people have to go participate in this event. In The Conformist, which is an amazing sequence, it's all about the point of view of the woman as she sees this thing happen. and feels the threat coming her way. And what we tried to do in Aang's version of that was to multiply the points of view and make the murderers themselves feel that same sense of threat
horror
coming their way.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because this is an unrated movie or is an NC-17 movie, lots of attention has been given to the very explicit scenes of lovemaking. Did you begin with the idea of that being an important part of the movie?
Well, I know I'm going to get into sex. The title has lust. It's a big lust there. Yes, I think it's important that sort of anchor the emotion and the niche and the essential elements of the movie. To me, that's the anchor. And that's the ultimate performance, too. The two brave actors. I was very uncomfortable, very nervous. I feel like in hell. It's kind of painful, but to me...
Painful to make or to watch
painful
now?
Painful to make. No, I think it's very intense to watch. I don't say pleasurable, but it's very intense.
The fact is the film is very much about truth, emotional truth as well as narrative truth. Who's telling the truth? What's real? And here are two characters. One is a spy. The other is spying on that spy, seducing him with the purpose to assassinate him. And so the sex really functions in that way. It's not the typical NC-17 sizzling, salacious pitch that you get a lot of times from these kinds of films. It's something much more, as Aang says, intense and I think quite profound.
In China, this version is not being shown, right?
No, but it's so interesting. No, it's a general audience version. I caught it myself.
The film was released in its integral version in Taiwan
and
in
Hong Kong.
And that's
and
been
now
for,
Singapore.
And now it's opened a little later in the mainland, where indeed, and it was quite a process. At first, it looked like it would only be a couple minutes of cuts, and then the cuts got a little bit bigger and bigger over the
last few weeks. Matter of negotiation with some authority?
You don't really negotiate. They kind of tell you.
Oh, really?
seems like it. So that's fine. And it was an unbelievable tidal wave of a rush to see this picture last week when it finally opened in the mainland. So it's very exciting because during the course of making the movie, I think Aang really was truly convinced that no one in the Chinese language world would have an interest in the film and probably revile it. It is so transgressive and so radical in its re-envisioning.
Politically, of historically transgressive.
Politically, historically, and I would say in terms of its sexual politics and this depiction of, in particular of women's desires.
I think there's a hunger to see something like this, a touch of humanity. That's very moving and very encouraging to me. This might be the first movie that all three part of Chinese language major territory sort of agrees on. I think the existence of the movie, whatever the form is, itself is a landmark.
Watching Lost Caution, it reminded me that there is a sort of pattern of secret identities in a lot of your films. Brokeback Mountain, of course. But one of your earliest movies, The Wedding Banquet, is about this successful Taiwanese guy in New York, and his parents don't know he's gay, and he agrees to marry a Chinese woman to get them off his back. Let's listen to a clip of The Wedding Banquet.
I said, forget about it.
Don't you see? This way, Wei Wei can stay in the States and paint, and you can finally get your parents off your back.
Forget about it.
Look, we can move her into the basement room until after the immigration exam, take some photos, send them back to your mom and dad, and perfect.
Forget it.
Hey, and as a married couple, you'll be able to take a big tax break.
It's Ang Lee's The Wedding Banquet. I'm always interested in what artists feel about their early work. What do you think of that film?
It's a funny movie. Thinking back, as I thought to myself, what happened to me? I started out my career with comedies, social satires, and after Sense Sensibility, I made six tragedies.
It's really,
I would like to go back to that.
He's really suffered the longest midlife crisis in artistic history. Hearing that, you realize.
But a productive
one. It was funny.
Yes.
The movies were funny.
Wedding Banquet really presented to all of us this opportunity to take a topic that was really serious and really important, and using American genre, in this case the kind of screwball comedy of remarriage, just making it gay and Chinese kind of revived it.
But there is this, again, in this...
The identity crisis, yeah.
Yeah, and especially sexually charged identity crisis that you return to again and again. Why is that?
I wish I know. I guess maybe, first of all, I'm sexually repressed. Secondly,
okay.
It's a good
one. I hope my wife is not listening to this. She's a big fan of yours. But secondly, I do have identity problems. Like, what's the deepest cultural root for me? All my life, you know, I've been a foreigner. We've been an outsider in Taiwan, and then I come here to the States as a foreigner. When I go back to China, I'm Taiwanese or American, whatever.
But feeling like a perpetual outsider, it must, I would think, it would give you special gratification to make these quintessentially American films that you've made.
I think part of that is that because I'm not really rooted in that culture, my resource come from the reality, not theatrical conventions. I think in some ways...
Not the theatrical conventions, you
say? No, like when I get into Western, I, you know, talk to Western people and look into the literature and documentary. Same thing with Sense Sensibility. I check into the painting or literature, what have you, instead of theatrical.
So you're not blinded by the learned, mediated, iconic understanding of these things.
Right, impression. I had that problem when I do Chinese film. But
that's funny.
I see clearly what it is from a distance. But then the texture itself, I have to adapt and learn quite diligently and always look around and smell if I did the right thing. People say I sometimes twist genre.
Mm.
I sometimes feel I'm just untwisted, like set it straight. But that's just the way I see it.
Uh-huh. There are at least a couple of scenes in Lust Caution where the heroine goes to the movies. Were there movies you saw growing up in Taiwan that sort of planted the filmmaking seed and made you say, geez, I want to do that?
I always love to watch movies. And I'm like her. I'm very easy to cry. Sometimes I cry so hard, the whole row of audience laughed. Look at that kid. So I daydream. I never think I'll be a filmmaker. I think one movie, when I was 18, I was actually in the Academy of Art, that I watched Bergman's Virgin Spring. That sort of epiphany for me, I think. Well, director's a superstar. How wonderful if you can ask where God is with such beauty. I remember that. That sort of turned my life around.
Yeah, Bergman is a real bonding thing for us. While we were in pre-production on this film, and Aang was in Hong Kong and I was flying back and forth in New York, we got the opportunity to visit Bergman on his island in the Baltic in Foru. They organized some screenings of films, and he had selected as the one non-Bergman film to screen that weekend in the summer that they'd done it for a few years, The Ice Storm. And the woman who ran the screening said, you know, please come out and visit, but don't expect to see the guy. And in fact, they organized a dinner and he didn't show up. And then we got the phone call the next afternoon saying, if you can be ready in 10 minutes, the car will pick you up and come on out and meet the man. He's actually invited you to his house. And the scene was just extraordinary when Aang got out of the car and saw him.
Yeah, it was just a hug. It was like this man's took away my innocence, so to speak, because the world has changed. When I was 18, and now he gave me a hug, like very motherly hug. That was something. Life is all right. It's a pilgrimage experience for me.
And in the nick of time before his death.
We were, unfortunately, the last people to visit him.
He's like God to us.
Yeah.
But somehow we get to meet him and almost have his blessing and his hug so warmly. That was something.
Aang Lee, James Seamus, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lust Caution is out in theaters now. And finally this week...
Well, yes, I paid a price, but everybody does one way or another. You pay a terrible price if you don't express yourself. It just seethes within and makes you ill.
That's Norman Mailer, whom I spoke with here in Studio 360 in February. I'd asked him whether all his notorious fights and troublemaking had hurt his reputation as a novelist.
I really consider self-pity to be poisonous. And I really, whenever I find a trace of self-pity in myself, I try to extirpate it, almost like a germ, if you will. And the periods of my life that probably embarrass me the most are those where I was being phoniest.
Norman Mailer died a week ago, aged 84. You can hear our entire conversation from earlier this year at studio360.org. That is it for today's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next week. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Special thanks this week to Jocelyn Ford. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein, Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Kevin Ryan,
Dillian Goodman,
Ben Conniff,
Richard Ye, 我是叶怀德.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, and SCG, whose charitable resources support FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, online at fjc.org, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
People in the carnival.
Bob Dylan, 1961, making up his past.
Did you travel with it, or did you watch the carnival?
I traveled the carnival when I was 13 years old, all the way up till I was 19, every year.
Dylan was passing. Dylan was pretending he wasn't a middle-class Jewish kid from Minnesota.
Director Todd Haynes and his new Dylan biopic, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to PRI's Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. You can find out more about this episode and access our entire program archive at studio360.org.